Who is that?
Jazz.
Bastard.
Are we ready for George Coleman? A George Coleman song? What are we going to call this? I've got Coleman's Mustard, which makes no sense except maybe he's a mustardy player. I've got By George. We got to workshop a title for this one. What should we call this?
Well, the other thing I know that is associated with the name Coleman would be those Coleman stoves that you go camping with.
Cooking with Coleman.
Yeah. Cooking with Coleman, something like that.
All right. Yeah, that's probably
camping
better
with
than...
Coleman. I don't know.
Well, camping. I'm not going to go with cooking. That's more of a jazz phrase. Camping, it sounds more like we want to date the guy. And he doesn't want anything to do with us. So anyway, I think maybe it was, I don't know. I had this recording and you said, well, let's focus on George Coleman. The new recording we're talking about, which is not new at all, a 1971 live recording that came out last year, is George Coleman in Baltimore on the Reel to Reel label. That's R-E-E-L, as in reel of tape, to R-E-A-L, as probably, I guess, part of the real world. And so you thought, well, let's build a show around other recordings featuring Mr. Coleman. And so we picked Miles Davis, and you told me to remind you that it was okay to talk about both.
Yes.
My Funny Valentine and Four and More.
Yeah. That's cool.
Two recordings released from the same live concert. The concert was 1964. The recordings came out in 65 and 66. We're also going to talk about Herbie Hancock's Maiden Voyage from 1965 on Blue Note, and then Elvin Jones's Polly Currents, 1970 on Blue Note. So these are mostly recordings featuring George, one where he was the putative leader, but George actually does not release an official leader date until 1977. So he did not record, you know, as a leader very extensively. Up to this point, he's released roughly like 14 albums with him as a headliner or a co-headliner. So did you have a preference as to what we talk about first here?
Nope. It's all good. It's all George all the time. We're good.
That's right. It's a George-a-palooza.
Which he is, astonishingly, still with us.
Yes.
George Coleman, I believe, is retired, but George is around. So I hope he's listening. George, we love you.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've been thinking a little bit. George is probably best known to the average jazz fan as a tenor player who worked with Miles Davis in the interim between the first great quintet with John Coltrane and the second so-called great quintet with Wayne Shorter. And there's this period of time when Miles is rotating out tenors. So he has Hank Mobley in there for a while, and they do some live recordings at the Black Hawk. Those later come out in a complete set, and those are recorded back in, I think, I want to say 61. I've got this information somewhere. Yes. And then Coleman comes in, and somewhere in there, I think maybe between Mobley and Coleman, briefly Sam Rivers, the avant-garde tenor saxophone player, on the recommendation of Tony Williams, a very, very young drummer with Miles, briefly appears with Miles. And then, you know, after Coleman's run, Miles gets Wayne Shorter from Art Blakey. Now, George is born in 1935. Wayne Shorter's born in 1933. But I think it's pretty clear from the recorded legacy that Coleman leaves behind that he is more rapidly kind of comes to a technical mastery of the horn. I mean, he plays with Max Roach. He also records extensively with Chet Baker in one 1965 session that they made five albums out of, called Smokin' Groovin', Comin' On, Cool Burnin', and Boppin', obviously kind of looking back to the series on Prestige by Miles. But even as a fairly young man, he's got this incredible technical mastery. And if you listen to early Shorter stuff with Blakey, he's still fumbling a bit. But of course, he ends up being the more famous musician, probably partially because he's such a composer. Thank you. You know, I gotta admit, My Funny Valentine 4 and More, they just don't happen to be the Miles Davis albums I grew up on. So I realized I've listened to them, certainly, but not as much as some of Miles' other stuff. So what do you think of these live recordings by the great quintet with George, with Herbie Hancock, Ron Carter, Tony Williams, and of course Miles?
I feel like George Coleman is kind of he's fallen between two stools because, you know, Coltrane and Shorter are just a lot more well-known, a lot more famous, and the second quintet had such a influential run, you know. But George Coleman, I mean, Miles Davis had massive respect for him. There was no diss, you know, toward George Coleman at all. It wasn't like he thought the guy wasn't a good player. He thought he was a really fine player. So I think sometimes the challenge when you listen to these is not to listen to this and think, well, how is this guy derivative or different from, or how does this guy not measure up to Coltrane or not measure up to Shorter? And just to try and take him on his own terms, like, you know, what is this guy good at? What can he do? And I try to do that with all of the albums. Some things come to mind. One of the first things is something that was brought up by a guest we had on, your pal Sophie Fott, when she was not happy with, I forget who we were listening to. It might have been Mark Turner. And she was saying, hey, you know, if you're going to play in the upper register of the horn all the time, play soprano, play alto, you know, go get a different horn. And one of the things that I think I've noticed in listening to all of these albums is the degree to which George Coleman is really comfortable in the lower registers on the horn and comfortable kind of improvising down there. And you know, that might have been one of the first things that made a sharp contrast with Coltrane, because Coltrane, in addition to the fleetness in his facility, you know, begins to move toward energy music and toward expression and toward this, you know, keening, wailing, banging his head against the door of heaven kind of stuff. And that's not Coleman's métier. You know, Coleman got started with a lot of, you know, R&B outfits, basically. He worked with people like B.B. King and Ray Charles and so forth. So he kind of cut his teeth in those venues, and he is not, I'm going to say, he is not like an upper register of the horn wailer. I find him to be a kind of muscular improviser, and I'm particularly taken with the kinds of things he gets up to in the lower registers on the horn. I don't know about you, but I don't think that he builds solos with the complexity of a Coltrane, but then again, who does, right? However, that is not to say that his solos aren't interesting and that he isn't able to hold his own in the illustrious company that is the second quintet. I think he comes off pretty good on these dates, especially, you know, there being live dates. You know, when I listen to the recordings, you know, and you get, there's an MC who does an introduction, and my heart bleeds a little bit because everyone raves about Tony because he's a kid. And then, of course, Miles. At this point, everyone's all in on Miles. And the applause for Coleman is always tepid. And I'm like, come on, man. Show the man some respect. He deserves more respect than that. He's not Coltrane, but he's not trying to be Coltrane either. To his everlasting credit, he is not trying to mimic. He's not going to go into Coltrane's bag or try and play that bag. You know, he had massive shoes to fill, but he didn't try and fill them by lacing up John's Brogans. He did his own thing. So yeah, I think of him as having, he's a little bit faster than, say, you know, Dexter Gordon is another kind of muscular tenor who spends some time in the lower register of the horn, but Dexter's a little bit more sinuous and lopey. Coleman is a little, like, I don't know how to put it, he's a little busier, he's a little more energetic, but not frenetic, you know? He's got a little giddy up, but he never sounds rushed, or I don't hear him sounding out of control. And maybe, this is pure speculation, maybe that's why Miles didn't keep him. Coleman, you never have the sense that he's a high wire act. You have the sense that here's a guy who's playing within his range, playing within his talents, and I think fitting himself to what the other guys in this quintet are doing, but not, you never have the sense of danger. Like, we talked about this with Bud Powell. Like, you always think, oh shit, now what's going to happen, right? And I would imagine, you know, when Miles played with someone like Sam Rivers, you had that sense every time Sam limbered up. Sam Rivers is like, what the fuck is he going to do now? And I don't think George Coleman gives you that sense of fear, that sense of, oh no, anything can happen, right? And I think Miles, I'm guessing this is all just, you know, Monday morning quarterbacking, but I think Miles liked someone who was going to bring something energetic and expected to the party, but also someone who was going to occasionally, not constantly or frequently, surprise, not never stop surprising. And, you know, I feel like Sam Rivers is an endless surprise, and you can imagine why, you know, someone like him, and it was a strong personality, sort of butt heads with Miles, you know, and it didn't quite fit Miles' mojo of young guys. So Coleman had that kind of bigger reputation. He's already kind of established as a sort of muscular tenor. You know, he played on a bunch of albums with muscular players, right? I mean, you mentioned Max Roach, but he played on Jimmy Smith's House Party with Lee Morgan. Like, you got to bring your A game at that. You got to be ready to sort of wail. You know, you got to bring your big, big blues horn to shows like that, you know? And I think he's good in those settings. He's fine in those settings. So I don't think he's the artiste, the tortured genius that Coltrane was, nor was he the sort of reticent composer / wizard hiding behind the scenes, you know, whatever you want to call Shorter. But he's good of his own kind, and he's better than people give him credit for, I think. The way I end up placing him is, I think of, and you can say what you want here, and you may say I'm just wrong, but I kind of place him between Mobley. For me, he's a little less muscular and husky than Mobley, and he's a little less sinuous and silky than Dexter. He's kind of in between those two guys. That's the kind of sound that I feel like he has. And I like it. I think it's good. I think he's enjoyable. And I think it's a shame that he isn't better appreciated for his time with this quintet, because he serves it well. He serves it well. I don't know. I like these. I like both of these dates. I think they're fun. What do you think?
You know, the story behind these was that this was a concert where Miles informed the band kind of as things were starting, oh, by the way, you're not getting paid for this. This is for charity. And apparently that pissed them off, and that brought a kind of extra energy to it, because I think these are strong live dates. There is some real energy and tension in them. Yeah, I guess to me, you know, Mobley, I just don't think – I love Mobley. I have a lot of Hank Mobley recordings. And Mobley, in a way that Coleman did not, found a home in Blue Note and was extensively, I think probably over-extensively recorded.
Yeah,
I think that's true. there's a few sessions there that might have been left in the can, and many that I just love to death. But of the two of them, I think probably Coleman's a more technically just secure. I mean, he really is a executant to be admired. I mean, he's really got a lot of control and speed on the horn. But I think you're right in that he's maybe not as expressive or eccentric as Shorter could be. And I think more importantly, Miles was looking for a new music director and a new book.
Yep.
And you can, this concert, which is really not that far away, but if you think about it, 64, you know, Kind of Blue is what, 59. It's been a few years, and things move pretty quickly in jazz at this period of time. And of course, Miles himself was someone who was known for forging ahead. And a lot of people have seen a holding pattern in the music between Kind of Blue and ESP. Some of the same songs keep coming up. And I mean, there's a lot of, I mean, I love the Blackhawk sessions. I love these sessions. Seven Steps to Heaven, which is kind of transitional, moving that way, where he finds an interesting composer and the drummer and vibes, Victor Feldman, who interestingly appears on three tracks on that album. And those are the standard tracks. And then the Victor Feldman charts appear when he's not playing, but Herbie Hancock is, and those are the ones that you really remember. And Coleman's on that and plays excellently. But it's kind of this period where he's kind of it's a kind of a holding pattern for him musically to some degree. And you know, Miles plays differently in every circumstance. He gets a little bit more aggressive with Mobley, who's a little bit more regressive, you know. But he's looking for the next breakthrough, and I think, you know, Coleman, is a great player. He's not a composer. I mean, he's somebody who does not, he's not known for his compositions or his, you know, new conceptions. He's just an excellent musician. So yeah, he wasn't necessarily the key to the ensemble that, that Miles wanted. And we got to point out that, I mean, you know, even Tony Williams and Herbie Hancock, who both composed extensively and Herbie very, very successfully, rarely got their tunes approved by Miles. Was picky, you know, he really wanted shorter. So he let some of these other guys, you know, they get a tune or so in there, but it was Shorter who was allowed to kind of build the book. So I think that's part of it. And the other thing I think that just happens is, unless you come, you know, the thing with Miles on Columbia is he makes a lot of fucking good records on that label. There really aren't many weak ones. And so these are very good, but unless you come up with them or you've got a special relationship to them, whatever it would be, they're competing with so much else in the library. And because they are covering tunes that, you know, get covered for a period of several years, it's a little harder to pick them out and learn about what's special about them. You really have to bore down on them in a way that, you know, there's a pretty dramatic difference between Milestones or Kind of Blue or Miles 58 and, say, you know, Miles Smiles. I mean, there's, I think a novice to jazz is going to say, that's different from that, isn't it? You know, you get a whole different vibe. And, you know, between what he was doing with Gil Evans and what he was doing with the original quintet and sextet, this is more just really, really good jazz, but it's a little bit less identifiable as, you know, this introduces X new concept or new sound. So I just think it's, until you really bore into the catalog, it's a little harder to find. But yeah, I agree with you. These are excellent performances. I do think the band is energized, whether out of anger or nervousness. They also said they were nervous about appearing live before this group. It was like apparently the concert was co-sponsored by the NAACP and the Congress of Racial Equality and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Obviously, none of those organizations need to exist now because all our problems have been solved. But back then, hard as it is to believe, we had problems of race and violence to confront. Now, I read this, you know, Ian Carr apparently claimed that, well, four and more of the songs were taken too fast and played scrappily. But then he considered My Funny Valentine as a Stone classic. You know, I don't know. I think they're both, to me, closer in feeling than that. I don't know that they're that, you know, they're all, and they, you know, mostly My Funny Valentine is ballads. They have at least one up-tempo number. Right. Mostly four and more is fast up. But you know, they weren't idiots. They didn't just make, you know, the same tempo, you know. So I think both work pretty well as records. But yeah, I think they're satisfying. I mean, it is a great quintet with a different tenor player. I wouldn't put them up there with a Plug Nickel, but
right.
I like them quite a bit.
Would you prefer these dates to the Blackhawk with Mobley?
This is the thing. I think at some point you'd hate to choose. I guess if I had to choose, possibly, I think that Coleman ultimately is more comfortable in Miles' world than Mobley was.
Yes.
And I, again, love Mobley. I just don't think that Mobley found himself in congenial circumstances there. And Coleman can play in any place you put him. I mean, he's, you know, he's not intimidated by speed or by complexity in any way, shape, or form. Where Mobley, I think of as a more classic hard bop player. He likes the, you know, and he's a good, he's an interesting composer, but not of the kind of thing that Miles wanted to play. So yeah, I probably like him a little better. I mean, obviously they're both really good. You know, Miles doesn't make much bad music. So, but yeah, probably by a hair, I'd say. So, you know, and I feel like it, you know, if you look at Rivers is too out. Miles is never going to be happy with Rivers. And Mobley is just a little too regressive and a little too in the hard bop mold. Whereas Coleman, I think he does fine. I think what's missing in Coleman is literally just the music director aspect, you know, that it, and maybe the young people wanted to hear more mistakes and more strangeness. I don't know that that particularly bothered Miles one way or another. I think what he wanted is somebody to add to his book. So anyway, this is my thoughts. But yeah, these are strong performances. And for me, you know, it was nice to listen to him because I listened to Miles a hell of a lot. I've got way too many Miles recordings, but yeah, these, it's not like I dislike them. It's just they weren't rarely in the top of the rotation if I was going to pull some Miles out to play. So it's kind of cool to hear them.
Good.
Well, I was thinking maybe go to Herbie Hancock next.
Yeah, sure.
The Stone Classic, one of the gems in the Blue Note Crown, Maiden Voyage. It's interesting in that Herbie makes a couple records for the label, and they're both, you know, I've always found my point of view just a little bit stodgy.
Hmm.
Taken off, it's got Dexter Gordon on it, and again, you know, love Dexter to death, but he was not the tenor player that Herbie was going to step out into the great unknown with, you know, he's not Mr. Modal. And this album becomes, you know, kind of a breakthrough for Hancock and an all-time classic. Coleman, obviously, on tenor, Herbie on piano, Freddie Hubbard, a very well-behaved Freddie Hubbard on trumpet.
Yeah, very.
And it's Carter on bass and Williams on drums again, right? Am I crazy?
I think that's right, yeah.
So this and then Empyrean Islands are the kind of twin releases. And I sometimes think, is it just the cover art that makes them seem especially impressionistic? You know, I mean, they are, but I feel like there's this narrative built around, which after, you know, Maiden Voyage was originally a fucking like cigarette commercial song, just something, you know, but he somehow made this. It's one of those albums that has a mythic presence that has to do with the art and the concept and the titles and the fact there's a couple standards on it and the mood. And yeah, we have, I think Coleman does brilliantly. I think Hubbard does brilliantly. And somehow Herbie in the studio creates his mood, right? So is this one you've listened to for many years, or what's your story with Maiden Voyage?
Yeah, I've had this for a long time. I got this in Empyrean Isles at the same time. I've been reading, you know, there's a lot of, apparently, you know, I'm not as deep into Hancock that I have a dog in this fight. But apparently there's a fair amount of huffing and puffing of chests about, you know, are you a Maiden Voyage or an Empyrean Isles person?
Oh, really?
Yeah, I was looking into, I was reading some of the back and forth on Rate Your Music, and there's some people who have very strong opinions about, well, Maiden Voyage is just overrated shit, and Empyrean Isles is where it's at. You know, there's some... Apparently, there's people get heated about this. To me, I always felt they were kind of a piece. They felt like they set similar moods. And when I started reading that, I thought, am I stupid? Have I not been paying attention? This is mostly of one mood. Eye of the Hurricane is a little more up-tempo. But it, yeah, you're right. This is sort of, this is modal. It's real pleasant. I find it works supremely well as like, I hate to say, this sounds awful, but this is a great album to put on at like a dinner party, you know, because people can talk over it. But then if you suddenly start paying attention, you're like, hey, that's actually pretty good. You want, I sort of feel like an ideal, if you're going to have, remember when we had dinner parties? An ideal dinner party album is one that's like, not obtrusive, but then if you start paying attention, you don't go, wait, what is this shit? You know,
yeah, if the conversation gets boring, you know, we can entertain ourselves listening to the music, but
exactly.
It's not going to serve the people who are, yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, the mood on this is very mellow and chill for the most part, even though, like I said, there are some up-tempo moments, but it's pretty mellow and chill, and you can totally, like, relax to this, but then if you suddenly start paying attention, you know, you're not going to say to yourself, well, this was a bad choice. You'll be like, wow, this is kind of good. I kind of, what is this? You know, you can imagine people saying, what is this? Because, you know, it's obviously a step beyond bop. You know, there's not these, you know, verse chorus things you can sort of hook into. It's got this different feel to it. But the playing is of a very high level. I agree with you. I think Freddie Hubbard is mostly pretty restrained. And George Coleman really fits into the setting well, which makes you wonder, you know, did Herbie miss the guy? You know, is he like, let's get George back in the studio. George had that thing, whatever that thing was. Let's get George back. I've wondered how that goes. You know, I mean, did Wayne say, well, why don't you call me, man? You know, or is it just that Wayne was busy and so Herbie had to, you know, find someone else who he knew could execute this music well. I mean, I have no idea what the backstory is, and you know, whether George was his first choice or, you know, Wayne wasn't available. But he sure does fit here, doesn't he? And there's a lot of there's a fair amount of the unison kind of play. It's one of the things I've talked about before. So the second quintet, I'm always struck with the ways in which Miles doubles Wayne Shorter's lines, but he's never quite on them. There's always this sort of mild dissonance in the tempo. Or in the stops and starts, you know, they're not in lockstep. And I noticed a little bit of that on this album between Freddie and George. And I, you know, again, no idea if that was by design, but it's one of those things that reminds me enormously of the second quintet when you hear the lead horns sort of playing each other's lines, but not exactly in this sort of, you know,
right. It's not
rigid lockstep. That feels very Miles second quintet to me. And it's a sound I've grown to love a great deal over time. That I've always kind of associated with that group and I noticed it here. And again, I just wondered, I have no idea what the backstory is. It'd be great to, you know, Herbie Hancock's still around and say, why'd you get George for this album? Was Wayne busy or was George your guy at first call? You know, I'm kind of curious.
Well, it's right on the transition. I think, it's interesting to watch. It's like, not exclusively, but Shorter uses Hancock a lot on his projects. But Hancock does not. And I think partially is, you know, Hancock is an extremely flexible musician. And Shorter is a little more, he's kind of distinctive and eccentric. So it's like, do you want that particular flavor? And I think he was, in a sense, since Shorter is kind of dictating the musical direction of Miles's quintet, you know, if you bring him on board, is it going to sound a little bit too much like it? Where Shorter's like, it's fine. It sounds like it. It's my brand. But you know, right. Herbie's like, I want to be running things my way. So largely, Shorter's absent from his projects. Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, I went back. I did listen to Empyrean Isles again, and it gets a little more out. It can be a little bit more aggressive. It's only got Herbie on. Let me try again. It's only got Freddie on it. There's no second horn. But yeah, they're both very, very strong outings. I think it's kind of hard in the way they're just the art and everything else. They're kind of presented as you feel like these are the moments where Herbie's left kind of recognizable hard bop. And before he gets his interest in orchestration and large ensembles comes up, because the last couple ones he does are bigger projects. And then he's got that weird Inventions and Dimensions thing, and he's got some percussionists, and he's just kind of improvising in the studio, and there's no charts, and this weird one-off that, to my knowledge, he doesn't really duplicate again. And that's kind of his solo or his leader dates on Blue Note in a nutshell. But yeah, I think Coleman he's very fast, and he can get noisy, but he can also play fairly controlled and cool. And what I think the most striking thing about Maiden Voyage, along with the fact it's got a couple of earworms that just become kind of post-bop standards, is just that Herbie creates this mood that just wasn't, I mean, it was somewhat present on like parts of ESP. And of course, I was checking, it's like, well, he does a little one on this and little ones on ESP, which came first? Yeah, this comes out on Maiden Voyage like 7 or 8 months before ESP drops. So, I mean, it's the same year that tune turns up on first Maiden Voyage and then ESP, but it's more like an album about not quite as introspective and drifty as the slow songs on ESP, but, you know, just a notch more moving than that, but kind of about this meditative, quiet, gentle vibe, yet that's still serious jazz, and it's nothing to do with the bossa nova, you know, it's just this feeling that, you know, it's really striking, and that you don't necessarily get on many releases of that time, or certainly many Blue Note releases, or really any jazz releases. And so it's just hugely influential as a way of putting together a record, and a kind of move that wasn't always necessarily explored much before then. So yeah, I don't know. I know that I have a strong preference between those two. I think they're both interesting, but I do think that Imperian Islands is a more challenging in-your-face one, even though it's also got the Boogaloo song, you know,
right.
Cantaloupe Island, which, you know, it's a weird thing. I often thought it's like, well, they call it Cantaloupe Island, and do you integrate it mentally into this impressionistic framework because of the cover art, because of the name, where really this song could have been dropped on My Point of View and it would fit in okay. You know, I mean, in a way, is what is giving these records their unity is some of it, is some of the heavy lifting being done by external factors and just not purely musical ones. That said, I do think several songs on this album and Imperian Islands do just create a mood themselves musically that is pretty distinctive. And I think Coleman does great. You know, he's responsive. I think he's, you know, his playing is delicate. It, you know, there are times that he's not miles removed from the way Shorter sounds in terms of tone. He's just not quite as bendy, not
right.
Quite that cry in it that Shorter has. And the lines are a little bit more regular and, you know, just very much Coleman knows his fucking chords backwards and forwards. I mean, he is harmonically solid as fuck. And, you know, I think in these settings where the chords aren't so important, he does very well. But when he's called upon, he will play chord changes till the sun goes down. So, yeah, I've loved for many years. I think eventually they're supposed to let this one out on vinyl, and I'm looking forward to that very much because it's a really good one. If you don't have Maiden Voyage, you probably should. It's a good album. And you're right. I mean, it's the kind of album I think that at least would be considered pleasant by most people.
Yeah.
They might not love it or get it, but I mean, they wouldn't be angry about it. Right. You know, it's like, okay, well, that's good old people music. Put that on.
Yeah, I mean, I hate to sort of use that as a rubric for discussing jazz, but, you know, this is at some level about pleasure, and I could see anyone getting pleasure from this. It's not painful, you know, it's enjoyable at a basic level.
Right, and it's just, but and of course the other part of it, realizing, you know, Hancock did movies or music for cartoons and for movies and for commercials, you know. He's an amazing artist, but he was also living in the real world and trying to make it as a musician. And, you know, and it's just, he came up with this amazing piece of art that, you know, began his life as a jingle. Oh, Mr. Jones.
What's that about?
Isn't there like a song about Mrs. Jones or Mr. Jones or both of them?
Probably.
I was just thinking, you know, our next album is Polycurrents. Elvin Jones. I think one of the tunes on it is called Mr. Jones.
Isn't there a Coltrane tune called Mr. Jones?
Oh, I'm sure that he does. He does this album they assemble after he's left Atlantic that's all blues. And one of them is like, yeah, to Mr. Jones or to Elvin. One of the, you know, he's very aware. Of course, Elvin Jones, the great drummer, best known for his stint with John Coltrane's fantastic quartet. Let's see here. Something like Coltrane Plays the Blues. Yeah, that's the name of it.
Yes, that's correct.
No, Blues to Elvin. Okay. But he may have another tune called Mr. Jones. Anyway, after Mr. Jones left Mr. Coltrane, he made a whole bunch of records for Blue Note. And we're talking about Polycurrents from 1970 on Blue Note, which features George Coleman, of course. Something like 10 albums. I got the Mosaic box set of the Blue Note recordings by Elvin Jones, and there's a lot of tenors on there. I mean, not many piano players. For the most part, he does not use piano players, but a lot of tenor players. This particular recording has, of course, Elvin Jones on drums, George Coleman on tenor, Joe Farrell on tenor, English horn and flute. That should make you happy.
It did.
Pepper Adams on baritone sax, Wilbur Little on bass, Candido on congas.
Candido.
Fred Tompkins on flute number 5. That's the one I assume was horribly out of tune, because Joe Farrell's never out of tune. There's a flute that is not right. I'm blaming Fred. So from time to time, I've dipped into these records and, you know, this many records that Elvin released. And, you know, some have one tenor. He begins with just Joe Farrell. Some have up to 3.
Yes.
Liebman's in that group for a while. Steve Grossman's in the group. It's a period in Blue Note's history where they are moving towards things like Street Lady and Bobby Humphreys and things. And you certainly could not argue anything, but these are pure jazz records. They are acoustic records featuring lots of improvisation, lots of serious blowing. And I like them all. I don't know that I've ever loved one of them. What did you think of Polycurrents?
This is a kind of trip, isn't it? I don't know. I don't know what I think of it. We did a show where we talked about one of Candido's albums. I feel like when he says his name, you have to say Candido.
I'm not energetic enough to even say it. Sorry.
Candido is a go-to percussionist. I am of two minds about the congas used for polyrhythms behind drums in this context, and sometimes I'm just down with it. And other times I feel like it muddies the waters. Yeah. And Candido's a great player, but man, oh man, I could do without the congas on this whole album. It's an Elvin Jones joint, and Elvin plays enough drums for 3 people. I don't think you need more percussion. I really don't think you do.
Yeah, well, and his patterns, you know, they don't slot in neatly to the average conga pattern, do they? They kind of rub. Yeah.
Yep. And I think that's deliberate, and you know, sure. I'm sure that Elvin was chill with that, but I'm not. It bothers my ears. It gets on my nerves. I don't need some sort of lockstep percussion that sort of matches identically to the drummer. But this feels like they're fighting one another almost, and they're not. I mean, obviously they're both in a good place. It's just, to my ears, it feels like conflict, and it's not a productive dissonance to me. I like dissonance, but this isn't productive. I think I complained about something similar on some recent album that had Big Black. I can't remember what that was. It was 4 or 5 podcasts ago. Big Black is another percussionist, and we did some album, and Big Black was on it, and I was like, man, I don't need that background percussion there. It just feels muddy to me. I love the horns here. This is a lot of fun. Joe Farrell opening on English horn is awesome. I just can't get enough of English horn in jazz. I think when I have endless disposable income someday, I'm either going to learn how to play the oboe or the English horn. I'm sure they cost like $800, but I love that fucking sound.
No, they don't. They cost a lot more than that, but yes.
Whatever, I'll take out a loan. And then, of course, it has Pepper Adams on Barry, and I love that fat bottom that you get. And then George just slots in here perfectly. This is very kind of at times sinuous and seductive. It lives up to its name, Polycurrents. I guess that's why Candido is here. But I'm less interested in the Polycurrents than I am in the interplay of the horns, which is rare for an Elvin Jones date, you know. I mean, Elvin Jones is in some ways Art Blakey's truest successor. He's all in all the time. He's got more tricks in his bag, I think, than Art does.
As a drummer, absolutely.
But he feels a little understated here to me, which is not a word you associate with Elvin Jones on any of his albums. Now, you shared with me Elvin Jones Live at the Village Vanguard. Ooh. And that's exactly the opposite. That's like all Elvin up in your face all the time. And I'm like, oh, yes, this is the Elvin I remember. this is Elvin on a leader date. I'm like, holy shit, dude, you're at a 10 and I need you at about a 4. Just, I mean, I love Elvin, but I'm like, holy fuck. Whereas here, this feels like an ensemble effort to me. And this feels, you know, subtle and, dare I say, pretty at times. And right, it's all about those three horns interlocking and playing with one another, and Joe Farrell bringing every horn in his bag to the date. It's a lot of fun. I actually, this grew on me. The more I listened to it, the better I liked it. And this shows George in a whole new light, doesn't it, right? We've got this sort of polyrhythmic, you know, Afrobeat thing going on. And George from the world of hard bop and blues, you know, and then the world of, you know, Miles Davis' second quintet, he just slots in just fine here. He seems like he's been playing this stuff all his life. There's no sense that he doesn't belong on this date, or that there's any sort of disconnect. The horns are great, so I enjoyed this. And this is a weird. This feels, you know, apart. You're gonna have to say something about the album cover in a second, but it's a strangely enjoyable date. So I have, you know, like you, I have a fair amount of Elvin Jones, and I think of him more as kind of like an energy guy. Happiest in the company of energy tenor players, where they're really expressing a lot of energy. And this is subtle. This is like, it's, you know how like you think about boxers, right? And there's boxers who are like, straight ahead, I'm gonna fucking knock you out, right? And that's how Elvin, that's what he reminds me of oftentimes on the drums. He's like, I'm gonna fucking knock you out, you know. And he's gonna play with, you know, burly tenors who are just gonna challenge. It's like, who's gonna play louder? And on this date, he's like, I'm gonna box. I'm gonna outpoint you. You know, this is subtle, which is not something I know. It's not a word I usually associate with Elvin Jones. He's not what I would call a subtle player. But this is a subtle date with beautiful playing by all of the horn players, and George is terrific here. I might like this the most, surprisingly. It was just such a surprise in so many ways. I thought it was pretty cool. I liked it quite a bit. And I think Pepper Adams, like, you can never have too much pepper. So.
And, you know, we got to remember that Elvin, among many other albums, appeared on Lee Konitz's Motion. So he can play quietly, but.
Right.
Yeah. Well, in a way, yeah, if Art Blakey kind of said hard bop, it's the greatest thing that ever existed, and I'm just going to keep playing it till I die. Elvin was like modal jazz. It's the greatest thing that ever existed, right. And I'm going to keep playing it and do my best to find a substitution for John. And, you know, well, one's not enough. Maybe two or three can substitute for him, you know.
Right.
And I feel like that's kind of the story of Jones on Blue Note, that he's just kind of experimenting with different permutations of, interestingly again, very few of these recordings have any piano presence.
Yeah.
Bass, drums, and multiple often tenor saxophone players or saxophone, and some with double on reeds. And just kind of exploring that at length in a way that, you know, he really, the great quintet, a quartet with Coltrane, doesn't last all that long, to be honest.
No.
And, you know, he's ready to explore these ideas for really the rest of a lifetime, whereas Coltrane kind of sheds them and wants to move on. So, yeah, I like this record. It's a little scattered, not too badly, but it is a little bit more variegated moods than you get on some of Elvin's stuff. As you said, the surprise appearance of flute and English horn, you know, it's just a little bit more very, you know, different moods, and that helps. Yeah, I would say, you know, I tried listening to Live at the Village Vanguard, and Hannibal Marvin Peterson on trumpet appears in the third track there, and I literally was like, I need to get under my desk now. Oh my God, this hurts. This hurts so much. So it's like
Hannibal the Cannibal.
Yeah, we're not going to do that one. Because I was thinking, well, this is going to, we're going to get more George because it's largely a trio.
We actually get less George.
But yeah, it's just kind of harshly recorded, and
it's rough. It is real rough to listen to.
And I've got, you know, I was talking about this album, maybe I was on Facebook, this album by Freddie Hubbard from the 80s called Outpost on Anja, and my God, he sounds so good. I mean he sounds good on CTI, he sounds good on Blue Note, but Freddie sounds fucking awesome on the studio album. But yeah, that particular date, Enja's engineers needed to get a couple sheep and stick them on the microphones. Several sheep were needed. We needed a little more stuff between us and what Marvin was laying down there.
That's a very sorry for those who didn't follow. We're talking about an album we didn't include for today, which is Elvin Jones's Live at the Village Vanguard, and it's a tough one to listen to. It's a difficult date.
It will get the wax out of your ears, people, from 1974, Ninja. And, you know, at times here, some of the soloing does get into what I've described often sometimes as a negative, that this person didn't do this. It's just kind of grinding in place. Sometimes I feel like the modal patterns, and whether just out of desperation or whatever, you know, the tenors will get into this. They'll play a pattern over and over and over again, trying to break through to something. And largely for me, it does not work. The many gifts that Coltrane had, one was just this incredible fervent earnestness and energy, the kind of an extra musical personality thing that whatever he was playing, it always seemed so incredibly driven and sincere that even if you didn't like it, you had to respect it. And it's not that I don't respect the playing on this album at all times, but there are moments where it's just like, okay, you just got yourself in a corner there. I mean, nothing musical's happening. It's just you're playing doodle 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 over and over again. It's like, just stop. That didn't work out. But, you know, largely the playing's really good. I mean, I've always been a partisan for Joe Farrell. I just think he's a delightful figure from the late 60s and 70s. You know, not a great conceptualist, and some of the stuff he did was fairly commercial, but his best, he's just remarkable, and he is like Coleman, a remarkable technician. So yeah, I enjoyed it. Like I said, all of the Jones stuff, which I keep dipping back in, you know, I'll go away from it, come back to it. I finally broke down and you know, the Mosaic sets in this case, particularly, it's literally just like 10 Blue Note albums stuck on 8 CDs, right? There's no bonus track. It's just, which is fine with me. I mean, I'm not really a huge fan of alternate takes. And a lot of times with these sets, what I'll do is, like with the Modern Jazz Quartet, I'm going to reassemble the files into the original albums, because really it's easier for me to absorb. Okay, this is standard personnel, one recording session, one theme possibly. It's 40 minutes. I can absorb that better rather than 60 or 70 minutes of a mixed bag of stuff that's just like disc one. I have a little trouble cathecting to that. Adding it to my mental library. It's better for me. So I put off doing this with Jones because I will say Blue Note's art department just went out the fucking window. You know, Jones is a good looking guy, you know, but they just have these badly done, almost amateurish photographs, and it's just, they're just ugly albums. They're not good. I think one reason that you don't hear as much about Elvin's run on Blue Note, along with the fact that it's not quite the classic period and the albums are maybe not as inspired as some, is just they just look awful. You know, who wants to collect things that look like that? So I don't know that this one's particularly worse than some of the other ones, but it's like, what happened? Where did your great designer from the 50s go? Can you come back?
I'll read to you one of the comments on Rate Your Music. One of the reviews says, Am I the only one who was genuinely scared by the cover? What is that woman doing there? Why is she even there? Why are they in the woods? And most of all, why does Elvin have a big pimp grin on his face like he just did something naughty in public? For those who haven't seen it, it's not a good cover. It's just not a good cover. It's frightening. Yeah.
Right.
It's Elvin looking like he escaped from a Renaissance fair. He's like wearing red pants and sort of a leather. No one should wear a leather vest. And Elvin's a good looking guy, you know, but I mean, he looks like he got out of a Renaissance fair and there's a woman behind him and behind some rocks.
I guess I'm assuming that's his wife, or maybe it's just a model. I just don't know. Yeah.
It's just really incongruous. It's a strange, you know, the title is Polycurrents and you're asking yourself, what does this have to do with the title of the album? And, you know, it's just a weird cover. It's not a good cover. It's just strange. It's just cognitively, it doesn't make sense. The cover.
Right. It doesn't, it's like, what are you trying to express? Why is this image on this record? And there's just no explanation. It's like, well, the camera worked and it made a film, and then we, you know, you need something better than that. Yeah. So yeah, it's just, yeah, it's anyway, they are all remarkably unattractive records, but I think, you know, the sound is fun. And again, if you're, you know, thinking, well, Luno gave up on jazz in the 70s, you know, this is clearly hardcore jazz. It's not, it's no attempt to cross over other than to appeal to the long-lasting, warm feelings about Coltrane's Quartet, of course. You know, I mean, there's that, but it's not pandering in any way. So the last recording, which again just came out for Record Store Day last year, it was a recently, you know, kind of archival thing that somebody came up with, but was recorded way back in 71, is George Coleman in Baltimore. This features, so trumpeter Danny Moore, piano player Albert Daly, bassist Larry Ridley, and drummer Harold White. And it was just kind of a pickup concert. There's apparently a jazz fan organization called the Left Bank Jazz Society in Baltimore, and they brought these guys in, and someone taped it. A member of the society taped it, and then this was released on Reel to Reel last year as a vinyl. I'm sure you can probably pick it up on CD. I'm not absolutely sure, but you probably can. And I think as we talk about, it's important to remember this was just a live gig. They had not planned to make a record out of this. So it's a snapshot of George in full flight and not in the studio. And it gives you a sense of the less buttoned up George. I mean, one complaint that sometimes was leveled against him was he was too contained. You know, Herbie and Tony wanted more avant-garde or out or just emotional playing. And, you know, Coleman, as excellent as he was not like that. But here, I think you hear him. He's playing off the cuff. You know, this is not polished stuff. What do you think of In Baltimore? Did you like it?
I wanted to know more about the Sidemen because never heard of them. I don't think I've heard of any of these. I thought maybe I'd heard of Danny Moore, but I don't think I know who he is either. So all the Sidemen are just new to me. Have you heard of these guys?
I feel like Larry Ridley appeared on some, probably on some later Blue Note, you know, like 60s Blue Note sessions. I feel like I've seen that name before. I really don't know otherwise. No, it's a pickup band, right? I don't think these guys went on to great fame. So yeah, I wish I had more information to give you, but it's really a lot of the documentation, and this is a nicely documented release. You know, one thing that I think these companies have learned, and I don't quite understand whether this is it's not the same company as the group that did like all the Bill Evans stuff, but I feel like they all seem to know one another. But they've learned a lot of this is these archival finds, these air shots and whatnot. Some of the secret to it is packaging it, giving people, you know, fairly big essays and background and things and photos and making more of an event of what would have been a bootleg 20 years ago.
Right.
But really those mostly go more into the circumstances of the organization and how this came about and what it was like to attend a concert held by this group rather than, you know, real in-depth look at the musician. So I couldn't tell you, did you like them or?
No, I did. And I was just trying to figure out who the hell these guys were. You do know Danny Moore, or you have at least him on one event. He's on More Blues and the Abstract Truth, the Oliver Nelson date.
Ah, okay. Yeah.
He also plays with, he plays at least once with Tad Jones. And I thought he played with someone else. I also know that he's on a Frank Strozier date, but he plays flugelhorn there. I thought he was interesting. The rhythm section's rough and ready, I thought. They're not bad. It's just, you know, it is a pickup band, and so they're all right, but they're no great shakes. So naturally my ears were drawn to, you know, what is George doing? What is Danny Moore doing? And I was just trying to figure out where I had heard him before, trying to place him. He's okay. I don't Danny Moore's fine here. I don't think he's great. Mm-hmm. He's perfectly serviceable for this kind of date where it feels like it's kind of like five guys doing hard bop, you know.
Oh,
it's, you know, verse, chorus, you know. I feel like Danny Moore can hold his own up during his choruses, so that's fine. But yeah, Coleman's in good form, don't you think? What did you think of his body and soul? come on.
Well, it's one of the great
Tell the class about Body and Soul first and then say,
well, just it's ever since Coleman Hawkins made this famous recording of it that was actually a jukebox hit, it's been a kind of tenor test piece, right? It's a song that at least up through the 50s and 60s that tenor players could prove their mettle on. One thing that Coleman does do sometimes when he is looser is he's willing to play ugly.
Yes.
And some of this stuff is ugly. I mean, you know, some of it's beautiful. All of it's played at a very high level. But just in terms of some of the licks he'll get into, and also, you know, his sound has a little vinegar in it.
Yeah.
You know, it is not the most luxuriant tone. It's a pleasant tone, but it's not, you know, he's not one of the players that it's just all about the sound. You know, he's not a Ben Webster.
I felt like this date was not particularly well recorded by comparison to the Miles Davis dates, which are just lavishly, beautifully recorded. And of course, those are big halls with, you know, state-of-the-art sound systems. And this sounds like you're in a club. It sounds like, you know, the mic has been soaked in whiskey or something. Coleman's horn he never is skronky, but he gets close. He gets close to skronk from time to time on this date.
The suburbs of skronk.
I like what you said about vinegar. There is kind of vinegar in his tone from time to time. I thought it was an interesting take on Body and Soul. And it's the only time I thought, gosh, I can hear some affinities with him and Coleman, just a little bit, because Coleman also is a fairly muscular player, you know?
Right.
And I was like, oh, okay, there's, you know, there's something there, you know?
And that's Coleman Hawkins, not Ornette Coleman.
Right, yeah. Coleman Hawkins, right, yeah.
I mean, two masters of harmony. I mean, guys that really knew the chords.
Right.
Backwards and forwards.
Right, right. I think I've told the story before on the podcast, but it's always a fun story to tell again about the time Coleman Hawkins was, he went to Europe, as so many black musicians did, to get respect and better pay. And he was in England, and he was going around doing different pickup dates or whatever, you know, with orchestras. You know, they pull together bands, and they would, you know, call basic tunes that he could, you know, play in his sleep. And one night, one of these bands, you know, this 15, 16 piece band, they decided to play, you know, whatever it was in a key, in a different key. And they started the song in a totally different key just to see what Coleman Hawkins would do. And, you know, by all accounts, what happened was he laid down a spectacular solo, and then he just turned around and looked at the band like with this kind of like a look like, really? you think a different key is going to get me? You know, it's just it, like just looked back, you know, this kind of, this very subtle look of like, you got to try harder, fellas. That's that's not going to catch me out. Anyway, yeah, I thought this was an interesting live date. And, you know, it's no Patch, obviously, on the Davis dates, but Coleman is featured more prominently, and you get a better sense of his muscularity on the horn, I think. And yeah, it feels like a kind of sweaty, gin-soaked date, doesn't it? Feels.
Oh yeah, very much. And this, you know, it's what it was. It was an amateur recording of a. Just a given club night. And so as a snapshot, especially, I mean, one thing this gives you is the earliest recorded example of Coleman leading a group, you know,
yeah.
Just because he does not, his first leader date, according to Wikipedia, who I bow down to for, is 77, you know, so it's interesting that he is an active musician for a good long time, but not somebody who gets leader dates the way, you know, Shorter, who is a couple years older, records first as a leader in 59. So it's just, you know, different. He just didn't get picked up by that system. He did a lot of Simon work, but he was not leading stuff. So this is, you know, really, this is literally just a year after the date with Elvin. And he's not left Elvin yet. I mean, and that, you know, the engine date we're talking about that peeled our ears was from 74. So, you know, but this is just him leading a pickup group. I'd say that if you want to get to know Coleman, as neat as it is to have this recorded example of his legacy, and also just to see him with his hair down, he's not really breaking rules, but just playing whatever comes into his head and not too worried about leaving a monument for posterity, not worried about the tape running. He may not have known it was running at all, just kind of blowing. This is a good example of it, but obviously not, I think, any of the other recordings would be better places to get to know him in a more controlled environment where he's, I think, more productive in a way. But yeah, that body and soul, I mean, that lets you know what he can do. You know, sometimes what he can do is hurt. You know, some of his legs is like, George, mercy.
He's going to wrestle the tune to the ground and win. That's what's going to happen on that take.
But yeah, I guess a way of putting it is, you know, this is George playing body and soul, just doing what he damn well pleases, not what somebody else wants him to do.
Right.
He is leading rather than accompanying. And he's a very good sideman. I mean, he's, you know, he's very
that
productive.
Also, you know, I mean, it's no one's going to say it's a slavish imitation, you know, it's his own thing. And, George, if you're listening or any of your friends, call us, George. We'd love to have you on the show. You could tell us all kinds of stories about how we don't know shit about jazz, and you can tell us stuff about, you know,
that would be a story. That would be true. But yes, you could also tell us about your life. And yeah,
you could also tell us about all the cool people you played with. So if anyone knows George, tell him to call us. We'll get him on the show. It's guys like him are what a legacy to talk about. So anyway, hopefully at the end of this, people will go, okay, George might be someone worth digging into. He apparently recorded one of the more interesting tributes to Miles, where he kind of got people together from all facets of Miles's career.
Yes, yeah.
And that's a celebrated, you know, Miles tribute date by someone who was kind of there at a key point in the career. And that I bet that would be interesting to listen to.
Well, yeah, if you look at like somebody like Charlie Rouse, who I think I have to sit down longer, but my guess is that Coleman is just a more technically accomplished player than Charlie. But, you know, Charlie's with Thelonious Monk so long that,
right,
you know, he's got a little bit higher profile, And Coleman just didn't have, aside from Miles, which, you know, he and I say seven steps is, you know, it's just hard to say. Miles just doesn't make many bad records. I mean, there's nights when that's way up there for me, even though, you know, in sober moments, I wouldn't put it in my top 20 or whatever. You know, that's kind of a memorable outing by him. And then, you know, these are, the live dates are quite good. You know, he has a moment there, but he doesn't, he's not associated with the leader long enough, as long that his name is as well known. So yeah, it's one of those players that, you know, Mobley, because of the Blue Note cult, is got a higher profile now than he ever did living. But Coleman doesn't quite have that in, and his playing is certainly at that, you know, that same level or above these guys that are better known now. So it's just cool. You know, he was around, you know, he heard the tape and he comments in the notes. So it's just kind of cool that he's there while his legacy is being explored and released to the public, not happening when he's gone. So it was kind of a neat aspect of it. It's a fun package, but, you know, and maybe it gets a little more royalty, so maybe you should buy it first. But then I'd also suggest you listen to Four and More and My Funny Valentine. And I quite, you know, the sessions he does with Prestige, with Chet Baker, the five albums, which were released on three CDs now many years ago, Stairway to the Stars and a couple others, those are good sessions. You know, they are very much hard bop sessions, trying to recreate some of the magic of Miles Davis's sessions from the 50s on Prestige, like Cooking and Relaxing. And it's just kind of cool. There's a lot of, you were mentioning this before, Tad Dameron tunes. There's several on there for whatever reason. They cover some of those. And those are just, that's a really neat sequence. So look out for those in whatever form. I'm not sure how they're around right now, but those are other sessions where you really get to hear George play at length. And he fits in beautifully with the less technically secure Chet Baker. You know, he's kind
of, God. Yeah,
he's the
yeah,
guy
yeah.
that knows all the chords, and they start out with Cherokee on one of the discs. He's like, well, George had no problem with that. You know, nothing got broken, but yeah. But those are kind of cool dates if you want to hear more, you know, George in a small group setting with a, you know, pretty good spark going. I kind of like those. Rob me and sabotage the spot, just like Pop when they got him in the lobby. Tried to tax and find me like Ronald Isley. Eyes to change, man, ain't no with fans or properties. Niggas used to know me, they don't even recognize me. Yup, the P5B is who the repertoire be. Doing it again just like Portier and Cosby. I'm like Martin Luther King, you like Rodney. The difference is I give it everything inside me. Yeah, diary, the fans still swear by me. Even though I'm late night now, like here's Johnny. That's where to find me. Funny how it break right down, but never mind me. Forever grind me. I guess it's just Philly shining. Rock roller, bipolar, like Phyllis Hines. Well, you got any pop on your mind? Any pop matters?
Yeah, sure. Just new acquisitions. In my ongoing interest to try and educate myself about hip hop, I picked up a couple of releases by The Roots. I think the only other thing I had by them before this was a date they did with Elvis Costello. I don't know why I got that. But this is, I got Phrenology from 2002, and I picked up How I Got Over from 2010, just working on kind of grokking that stuff. Just recently started listening to that, so that was fun. Picked up a Chemical Brothers album from 2019, their most recent, No Geography. Apparently people are still making kind of house party music, and so if you're into that, there's that. But the thing that I got that you'll like, that you'll ask yourself, why would you do that, is I picked up the Rhino 5-disc set of the Pogues. And it's not
better you than me, sir.
It's not even like a collection of the albums. It's a collection of like air shots and TV dates and live stuff.
So what's it called? Drunk, Irish, and Noisy? That's what
it's called. Just look them straight in the eye and say Pogue Mahone. And it includes stuff, you know, lots of stuff with Shane McGowan, who is the ugliest most beautiful man ever. Shane McGowan is, I had an argument with my partner recently about this, and I said, Shane McGowan is one of those people who is so ugly, he comes out on the other side beautiful. And my partner said, no, he doesn't.
He stays on that side.
He's still ugly. I don't know. Shane McGowan is a wonderful, he has an amazing face and an even more amazing voice.
Yeah.
But this includes stuff when he was away from the band for a while and Joe Strummer was the lead singer. And it's just a lot of live dates and stuff. I think so far my favorite is on disc one, an extremely drunk live recording of Danny Boy, which is really the only way you should hear that song. They also have a very tight version of Maggie May, which is pretty clever. They have some fun stuff. They're a fun. Look, you don't have to like Shane McGowan, but they're a talented band. They're really good at what they do. They have this sound that works. Yeah, I don't know. I kind of like it. I don't know. I'm enjoying digging into this. I know you're like better you than me, but
keep digging.
It's they've got like the mandolin and the guitar and the tabor, and they're actually a punk, you know, Celtic rock band. You know, they're a lot of fun. I think they're musically better than people remember. If you were our age when you were in college, you could not get away from hearing Thousands Are Sailing, which was their big, big, massive hit. But I think they're worth a listen, and I'm enjoying the hell out of this. And if you're not careful, I'll be sending some of it to you. Three out of five potatoes, say. Yeah. You know, and they can also just play flat out, you know, Celtic reels. You know, Waxy's Dargle is just a punk version of a Celtic reel, you know, and it's like, that's pretty cool. I mean, it's just they just take a basic, you know, and they just play it 15 times faster with loud drums. And you're like, that's actually really cool. I would like to be in an audience when that happens. So there's something to be said for this, even if you don't like it much. I think it's a lot of fun. And when you listen to it, you can also hear where calmer, more twee bands like the Decemberists come from. The Decemberists are the Pogues without the energy or without the punk, you know,
right.
But it's slowed down.
And a thesaurus, right, yeah.
And you know, less alcohol.
We hope.
And better pronunciation and more, actually fewer missed notes. Shane McGowan has about five notes and they're usually wrong.
Yeah, that's right. They're close to the melody, but never quite on it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, I think it's fun. I don't know.
Okay, sure. Well, you do you.
I'm getting off work early. You've been a good wife all these years. I haven't always been sincere. My resolve to leave never stopped.
How about you? What have you been listening to?
Well, a review copy that came through very recently by Brian Away. What a great name, Brian Away. Canyons to Sawdust. And if you remember that French group Fugo, or however you say it, Fugo.
I was just playing Fugu for the partner the other day, my favorite song, the one with the sort of waltzy tune with babies screaming.
Yes, you mentioned. I like this. I like the other album better. Anyways, it's this super soothing harmonies, very poppy, some roots in the Brian Wilson sound. I don't know what the lyrics mean yet, but it's well put together. I mean, it's, they're hummable melodies. He's doing making a good fist of that genre. I don't know how much it'll stick with me, but Canyons to Sawdust, kind of a pleasant listen. I was in a burger joint and I finally clearly heard the line in My Sharona where he says, I always get it up for the touch of a younger kind.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it ever quite. And then I realized I can't get this vision of Matt Gaetz singing this song out of my head now. It's just like, oh, so wrong. Anyway.
For the kids that listening at home, Pat just went political. Okay.
Yeah. The Knack. I think we talked about the Knack a few months back, and maybe we're saying, the revisionists, oh, they weren't so bad, blah, blah. It's like, no, wait, they were. They just weren't good people. That's not right. So you were mentioning you couldn't understand why people love Pat Metheny so much, and I did dub his live album Travels from ECM, and it is, he starts out with Are You Going With Me, which is this really kind of cool little riff melody from like his third record. It's like bump, 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 bump. And the whole point of it is it's like, it's just enough melodic interest that it does create a little bit of tension. And he starts playing it and it's like, yeah, the lighters come out. I'm like, okay, I guess are you lighting your scented candle? I mean, I like the music. I mean, I like it. But my reaction to it is not, yeah! So anyway, Pat has an effect on people we do not understand, Pat Metheny.
Yeah, I have more and more of his stuff, and I listen to it, and I enjoy it, but I am not a worshiper, and the people who are mystify me, and I don't think they can explain it. Like, he's crossed over into pop consciousness. I think it's the hair. He's crossed over into pop consciousness, and there are people who are like, oh, yeah, Pat Metheny, now that's good jazz. And I'm like, people who don't know anything about jazz adore him, and that always makes me suspicious.
Well, but, you know, whatever. I mean, if a few of them slip over and start listening to Bill Frisell, good, you know, fine. But, yeah, it struck me. It's like, well, I actually think it's a good
tune. If they slip over and start listening to Derek Bailey, it's fine. Sorry.
Dwang. That's right. And now it's time for you to suffer. No more nice coffee for you. Speaking of chilling out, I finally got around to dubbing XTC's Mummer. I've had that record for decades. And I don't know. That was the one where they went, I feel like it wasn't around. English Settlement was probably their masterpiece, even though there's two or three songs on that I just hate. But the rest of them I think are genius. And then Black Sea was kind of a bit of a mess, but there's some good stuff on it. And then it's just like they come back and then this pastoral, somewhat wimpy, tuneful. It was like Roxy Music after Siren. And all of a sudden, I mean, I love Avalon for its own sake, but it's like a personality change happened. They all were put on lithium or something. There's a couple good songs on it, but none of it's bad. It's just like a different group. And I did record the name of this band as Talking Heads and dub that as well. I don't know if the second disc of that live album of the Talking Heads, where they're doing the bigger group, I don't know if everybody's quite synchronized yet the way they are on Remain in Light. You know, there's like it's a little rough around the edges. It's like it's kind of cool, but not quite there yet.
Oh, but you've seen the Scorsese film, right?
Well, yeah, the film is. It's Demi, isn't it? It's not Scorsese. It's
oh, you're right. It's Demi, but it is one of the great.
Oh, I mean, the concert film.
Maybe the best. Yeah. Maybe one of the best concert films ever at capturing a band at a moment, and you're just like, this is perfect. It's
absolutely.
Really,
no, it's a fantastic movie. And I think there's a sound. Isn't there a soundtrack to that?
Like, yes, there is. Stop Making Sense. That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, this is. Anyway, it's not a bad record. But,
sorry, I'm saying no to the cat who's trying to crawl across the keyboard, which has a tendency to shut things off. She's like, I want to go there. And I'm like, you cannot go there. So
go somewhere else. So that's my pop stuff, a mix. But I'd say in terms of brand new, if you really like that soothing pop that traces its roots all the way back to kind of the Beach Boys era, you might give Canyons of Sawdust a listen. Again, I don't know that the lyrics mean a whole lot. I'd have to listen to it a few more times. Hopefully he's not saying, I always get it up for the touch of a younger kind at any point in there. I'm just, fingers crossed.
Is there any way that you would like a pop band if you couldn't make a reference or a link to the Beach Boys? Just curious.
It's possible, but how about this? The Pogues, nothing to do with the Beach Boys.
But you don't like them.
That's true. Well, that maybe proves your point right there, my friend.
Let me tell you something. The next time you have to make that long drive from Crawfordsville to the Jazz Kitchen in Indy, a long drive on the way back from the Jazz Kitchen where you've had a few too many adult beverages, let me tell you something. Drop some Pogues. They'll keep your ass awake through the prairie. Let me tell you.
No, I have Diet Coke. when we go there. Joyce is the one that needs the adult beverages so she can put up with all the jazz. You know, I actually went there. They had it was Ferris Whitted. I'm not sure how to say it. A trumpet player, very, very good trumpet player, quite a character, talked a lot to the and then sort of the house band. They covered, it was supposedly the weekend was devoted to Freddie Hubbard, but they only did one Freddie Hubbard song, First Light, and when they were through with it, it was done. I mean, it was like 15 minutes of just, the whole set list was kind of, this guy loves, it's like those ecstasy-inducing tags where they just get caught on a couple chords and just groove on them. It's just that every song was like that. And so by the end of it, I was kind of wrung out. But Rob Dixon was there on tenor, always fantastic player, and the local rhythm sections is fantastic. And it was a good concert, but a little too much of that. But yeah, they did the one Freddie, he's like, I guess it's supposed to be something about Freddie Hubbard will play. You know, he's a very transparent human being on the stand, didn't hide anything from us. And that was, I'd say, it was last Saturday. I'd say pretty much every table was full. You know, there's things in place, but they are moving back to normal. It looks like they're hopefully surviving this, the year of hell. They took 7 months off and remodeled, including, of course, making sure that the ventilation was really good, because
we're I just wonder if the bathroom has been improved since
No, you're thinking of the Chatterbox, which I think...
I don't think of the Chatterbox.
The Chatterbox I think, is now out of business.
Oh, I remember the Jazz Kitchen. Their bathroom was good. That was a good place.
And it's even nicer now, I'll tell you that.
It's very much like a suburban white people come to the city to listen to jazz place.
Well, I'd say that it was a 50-50.
No, I know, but it has that. It's carpeted.
It's a nice club. It's nice food. Yeah, Ferez's extended family was in the audience, so we're not all pale there. But
we'll have to get you to the Blue Whale when things are open again here in California. I can't wait to get up there. What I like to do is go and spend a weekend. So then spend two nights or a night. So you drive up because it's miserable to go to a club when you have to drive from San Diego to Los Angeles. That's like driving to Chicago, driving to O'Hare through rush hour. So you drive up and you just go to bed, and then you get up and do different stuff on the day of. But the Blue Whale is in Koreatown. So you go eat good Korean and then you go to the Blue Whale. I'm looking forward to hitting the Blue Whale again. Once things are in order, it'll be fun.
Cool. And that concludes Jazz Bastard Podcast 215. Want to reach us? Drop us an email at mike@jazzbastard.com or pat@jazzbastard.com. You can look me up in All About Jazz, or if you like, drop me a line on Facebook. The podcast can be downloaded from www.jazzbastard.com, from Apple Podcasts, from Mixcloud, from Stitcher, and you can stream it at All About Jazz. Tune in next time, as if the stars align and all goes well, we're going to interview author Will Friedwald, probably one of the great living experts on American popular singing and jazz singing of the 20th century. We'll be talking about Will's new book on Nat King Cole, as well as the liners he did for a large CD set of Nat King Cole's material, and hopefully, if time permits, some of Nat King Cole's best albums on Capitol. So we're really looking forward to it. We hope you are too. But till next time, take care.